everyone, and welcome to another episode of UpZoned, where every week we take just one big story from the news that touches our conversation here at Strong Towns, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I'm Kia, and I'm here this week with a little bit of an unusual story that I'm actually really excited to talk about because it's mysterious to me. It's from CNBC, and the headline is, "This Seattle suburb where Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates both live is running out of money." So obviously that is bait for any Strong Towns advocate, but I wanted to bring on specifically a Seattleite Strong Towns advocate. And lo and behold, I've got one. John Reuter, how are you doing today?
I am doing very well. Now I have to tell you, I am a Seattle enthusiast, right? And and happen to live here with my wife and my dog, Franklin. But I will say, I am still like after what, 3-4 years now, I still struggle to identify as a Seattleite and still feel like my eyes are a little new to the city, having come from the world of Idaho and rural Oregon previously. It's still a different world, one that I'm loving getting to live in, but one that occasionally mystifies me or surprises me.
Well, I can kind of see why from a glimpse at this article. It's pretty fascinating. And it's just sort of like, at least to my eyes here in St. Louis, having never been to Seattle, looks like a pretty cartoonishly insane example of something we talk about all the time in Strong Towns, which is this phenomenon of how can places that are ostensibly thriving, that are home to, in this case, the two richest people on the earth, be struggling to pay their infrastructure bills to deliver essential services. And the answer that CNBC comes to is the one that we hear a lot. It's that they aren't collecting enough taxes. Well, clearly, that's what's going on. However, what they are pointing to in this article by Catherine Clifford is that Seattle has a very unusual taxation system. Most cities in the country, in St. Louis, certainly this is the case. You are paying your infrastructure bills out of a percentage of your assessed home value, basically, that you pay in property taxes. Seattle has a little bit of a different system, but even within the article, they sort of acknowledge that even if they change that system a little bit and raise those tax rates, probably this suburb, which is called Medina, am I pronouncing that right?
Possibly. This is where I say my foreigner new eye status goes, Medina. I don't know. We're gonna have some real Seattleites, people who've lived here all their life, people who rightly identify me as the newcomer that I am, be like, oh, and a little eye rolling at this moment. So I'm not going to claim the local expertise beyond becoming first aware from this story by reading the Seattle Times rather than finding it on CNBC. So I'm just a set of outsider eyes who get to see all the things that happen in Seattle a little faster due to my proximity.
So maybe that's a good place to start, is just sort of what you're hearing around the street, John, about this Medina, let's call the whole thing off kind of a story. And how, as a Strong Towns advocate, you look at an article like this that shows, hey, this neighborhood where multiple billionaires live, where the median home value is over $2 million, and that's median, not average, just so you know, we're not skewing everything around the fact that we have someone building a spaceship for his own personal use, like is living in this neighborhood. How are Seattleites talking about this story?
So right now, Seattle's in the middle of city council elections right now. The obsession in Seattle right now is Amazon actually putting over $1 million into those elections, about $1.5 million into actually a slate of council candidates, specifically to try to like actually fight off an increase in the tax rate that they have to pay and other sorts of policies that they would rather have the city council vote with them on. So it's interesting because this is happening right next door. There have been front page stories about it. But there isn't really a lot of room in the discussion for anything, even a few miles away, right? It's the obsessions in Seattle, from my viewpoint, are the local council races, concerns around homelessness, and then Trump impeachment, right? That national story breaks through. I think that's worth just noting in general, right, is that suburbs aren't something that cities often pay attention to. In this case, a little different because you still have these really, really wealthy suburbs that surround Seattle. But infrequently, these suburbs are actually having struggles like this and don't have the benefits of having two billionaires. And by billionaires, I mean billionaires who have over $100 billion each in net worth, in both cases of Bezos and Gates, you know, that don't have that kind of like supreme amount of wealth in them. But in communities where the suburbs are starting to hollow out, you see communities that really get ignored. So that's one dynamic that I think plays out elsewhere, and in this case isn't quite as bad. The other thing I'll say about the story, though, is it's told right as a problem in cities having actually the ability to make decisions about their own tax rate and some of the caps in Washington state around how much you can actually raise taxes on people.
So let's kind of dig into the nitty gritty of this tax rate, because it is kind of unusual. And I did want to ask you about that from at least a Washington taxpayer, if not a Seattle expert perspective. The way that Washington does statewide their property taxes, it looks like you are capped at being able to charge a certain dollar amount per $1,000 of assessed value on a home. So what that works out to for Bill Gates at his house with apparently 24 bathrooms and a trampoline room. And I'm like, is one of the bathrooms also the trampoline room? I have questions about this. He is paying for that house most likely about $1 million a year. And of that, about $83,000 is going to the city that he lives in, the specific suburb. What impact do you think the tax policy in Washington state has on communities like this? And do you think that it's time to restore more local control to how we do property taxation?
Well, it's really mixed, right? Because a lot of the biggest portion of property taxes is going into two separate school funds, right? So one is a local school fund and the other is a statewide school fund. And that statewide school fund ensures that just because a community is wealthier than another community, that you're actually able to provide a uniform form of quality education throughout the state. So it's a little complicated when we say, should we just jump in here and have all of these tax dollars go to the local city? Now, that said, it seems to me like people should be able to elect a council and a local government that can tax them at whatever rate they want to be taxed at. And they can choose the government they want. And if they want to really liberal government that believes in more services and higher taxes, that's great. If they want a more conservative government with really low services and a low tax rate, I think that's actually fine too. I think those are decisions that, from a strong town's perspective, I have my own biases about which one of those governments and which one of those places I want to live. And from a strong town's perspective, you can have either one of those approaches. What you can't have is a place where you have really low taxes and really high expenditures. Or even where you have high taxes, but even higher expenditures, right? Or really low taxes, but slightly higher expenditures. You have to make sure, if you want your city to last, that how much money you're spending is actually less than how much you're raising. And we should give our cities the option to do what they need to do to make that work in a way that their residents want it to.
But then there's also the piece of this which has to do not with taxes, but with land use, right? About the actual cost to provide services to Xanadu 2.0, which is the name that Bill Gates has for his house. I keep clicking over into an article about his like 1,000-square-foot dining room because it's grotesque and fascinating to me. But I digress. Like, there's a much higher cost to service a property like that than to service a 1,000-square-foot apartment, you know, aka my house. So I'm curious what the land use implications of this is. Do you think that a bedroom community like Medina, that has large homes with large setbacks, is likely to ever be able to, under our current system of taxation, in even the most generous state, be able to support their infrastructure costs?
It's an interesting and complicated question. One, I think definitely this sprawl style development out there is a problem, and it's expensive even by the standards of billionaires, right? Even billionaires and millionaires, which is most of the city isn't billionaires. The average income in the city is a mere 6 figures a year. So, I mean, you know, this is a city full of certainly wealthy people by any standard that are struggling to actually be able to pay for the services they want in their city with their taxes. And certainly the square footage of that city is part of it. The other thing though, right, is that they want a lot of other things too. They actually want a lot of other services in that broad pattern, right? So it's expensive not just to provide pipes and road to those places, which is what we often talk about in strong towns, but it's also expensive to patrol the water along the edge of this city, right? Which is one of the things they're spending a bunch of money on. It's actually really expensive to actually hire lifeguards that they want to have actually on the beaches, right? To have these open public areas along here. It's actually really expensive to hire police and other public safety personnel to patrol this area, right? Because you have a pretty large area. And so you have these very significant homes that are obviously target rich, but at the same time, they are dispersed. So it actually makes it harder to either walk or patrol these things in an efficient way, which makes the cost of having police go up, which they've thought about, right? So the city's also installed a 24-hour security system throughout the entire city, which again, seems like a pretty expensive feature for a city that's going to lead to more costs. So there's a reasonable question here of whether the city has features that it doesn't need and services that it doesn't need. Although I'm not sure that the residents are really willing to give up those services. And I'm not sure they're really willing to pay the increased taxes. I think they're in a tough spot. And then, you know, you hear the city say, we're not trying to add fancy services or gold-plated cars, but it's kind of amazing what we thought is necessary to be a modern city, even in a pattern that isn't laid out the way an actual city or a town would be in terms of the kind of density and connection that you'd have. Does that make sense what I'm getting at there?
It does. But, you know, it raises these questions that I always have to grapple with at Strong Towns as someone who I've never lived in a big, expensive coastal metro. You know, the closest is Annapolis, Maryland. I went to college there for a couple of years. But most of my life, I have lived in places like St. Louis and Cleveland that are empty, that are have a lot of neighborhoods in decline. And I resonate more with, you know, I just listened to Chuck give the Strong America presentation a bunch of times when I was on tour with him. And he gives an example in that talk of exactly how much you would need to raise taxes per household in order to afford the infrastructure in, I think it was Shreveport, Louisiana. And right now the average taxation is about $1,500 and it would need to jump up to $9,500. And of course, in a city like Shreveport with a poor tax base, that's never going to happen. What's fascinating about the Seattle example is like, yeah, probably Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates could write a check, you know? Probably some of these individual residents could actually afford out of their personal income if a personal income tax was instituted. It sounds like Washington doesn't have one of those based on this article.
Right, no, or it's yeah, no income tax in Washington.
That's absolutely wild to me, but okay, cool. If that those income taxes were instituted, if we just jiggled the right knobs and levers on our tax code, that we could raise the revenue that we need, and we could basically buy those services that tip over the line into amenities. Walk me through why that still does not a Strong Towns make. Why can't you build a Strong Towns just by changing the increasing your revenues through taxation, but you actually have to reckon with your land use?
No, see, and this is where I'm not sure that it's not true. I think if they had a system of taxation where they could tax the billionaires on the beach, right, enough to actually cover their services, that would potentially be sustainable. The problem is that nobody actually really wants to pay that much in taxes. You know, like, this is the thing, like, Strong Towns is about actual real fiscal realities. I don't think it's about coming and telling you like, hey, if you have enough excess wealth that you're willing to spend it on what seems to be an absurd amount of money, and if that's going to be a 1,000-square-foot dining room or whatever, right, combined with 20 miles of road that you don't need either, by the way, and other luxury services and waste, which is really what we're doing in our towns, right? We've built out these massive waste uses of space, massive wastes of road that we don't need, things that are not making us any happier and are dramatically sucking up our wealth. But if that's how you want to spend that money, you can do so. And you are then a financially sustainable town and you can continue on. Now here's what I'll say about it, though, that I think it actually is, and I think we all have an intrinsic understanding of this. I think if our ancestors were to come and look at all of our city today, not just this wealthy suburb in this one place, I think they'd find it pretty gross. It's a pretty obscene way to live. It's a pretty wasteful way to live. It's a pretty inefficient use of the resources we have and the wealth we have as a nation, money that could be going into things that we really care about, like the future of our kids, like, you know, whether that's our education system or whether that's actually like actually just letting people have money to actually improve their lives, whether that's through enrichment of extracurricular activities they like. I don't buy that all this infrastructure, these extra miles of pipes, these extra miles of roads are actually making us happier. This really gets to the final chapter of Chuck's book, where he starts to say, look, there's been this big social cost to this stuff too. This actually hasn't made our lives better. It's actually often made our lives worse. There may be some rare places where you can keep living in this way in an extreme way by getting some rich people to write the bills, although they're finding out even in this very wealthy suburb that people don't really want to do that because they go, wait, that's too much money to pay for this because it doesn't actually increase my quality of life. Right? You might be able to do it, but you're not going to really want to because it's just not worth it. And that really gets at the central reality here.
I might just add too that even if like you ask someone that question, they're like, absolutely, I want 24 bathrooms in my house. I need a trampoline room. It is essential to my well-being. Again, to harken back to the Midwest, like the Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates equivalents of the 19th century lived in places like Cleveland and St. Louis, right? And they left. Even if you do justify this stuff, you know, like Rockefeller very famously left Cleveland and took his wealth to New York. And the estate, the like actually his Xanadu 2.0 that he left behind became East Cleveland pretty famously, which is one of the most hard up places that I've ever been. They can absolutely not afford their development pattern, even though they've been working really hard to adjust it for years and years and years. So yes, like this is something that I feel like I've learned from Chuck. Like, yeah, you can sure adjust Seattle's tax code, make the billionaires pay their fair share, say we can have anything we want, like we can turn our world into like a wonderland of infrastructure if we want to. What is the next generation going to want? Are we building something that's adaptable for needs? Can we unwind this? And the answer is usually with these gigantic suburban style houses, whether we're talking Xanadu 2.0 or just your average run-of-the-mill sheetrock palace in the suburb of any major city in America, the answer is no.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, right? That the sustainability of these places is short term, whereas the sustainability of a place that's actually built in a more rich mix, right, and a more dense pattern and a more strong town's traditional old school neighborhood pattern is going to just last longer and last more generations. I think that's a really good point. That even with the taxation rate, these places remain inherently fragile. That merely having the billionaires pay for it a while doesn't remove that the long-term fragility of these places when those particular people were to leave. What's really sad and what we're seeing happen, right, is that people are exiting these suburbs as they become more fragile, right? This goes back to the Ferguson example too, right, where people left the place, abandoned it. It was a place of wealth and prosperity, and then people had the ability to got out and left people behind, stuck with a mess. And then what did they do? They started having all sorts of really awful schemes to get tax dollars through police actions and basically like creating a really unfair system of taxation that was built on fines and fees of people taking actions like not walking on the sidewalk in situations where it was clear that it was safe not to walk on the sidewalk because there wasn't that much activity because of the built development pattern. I do think that there's that legacy there. And when we look a couple generations out, that's a really good point. It does reveal that this, that what could be made to work today will certainly not necessarily work 50 years from now.
The obvious point should be made too, that a lot of what drives people further and further out into the suburbs is when you make them pay taxes on what they think that they have already paid enough for. Rockefeller left Cleveland. John D. Rockefeller left Cleveland because they wanted to raise his taxes, basically. There is no earnings tax in St. Louis County, which is, by the way, not incorporated with St. Louis City, which does have an earnings tax. And that has been the driver of a lot of, you know, people going further and further out into the hinterlands and building more and more unsustainable things because those communities promising through these short-term windfalls of growth that they will keep the dream alive for a little while longer. If I had to predict the future, I think by the time that I'm in middle age, we're going to see St. Louis County hollow out. We're going to see, you know, if you tried to move the needle on Medina, Washington, you would see that place start to hollow out too, because every incentive, as long as we have taxation systems that are plastic, is going to get people to drive people to get the best deal that they can for themselves. It's how we create feedback loops that has become really interesting and crucial to me over time, especially in these very, very extreme cases.
I mean, I hear that, but then I look at a place like New York, right? New York City, that has a fairly high tax rate. And I even look around Seattle itself, right? Forget about the suburbs, but the actual municipality of Seattle that obviously doesn't actually have any control over this small city, suburb city. And in both of these places, you have an awful lot of wealthy people. You have a lot of people who are actually choosing to stay in these places, even though they might be paying a higher tax rate to live there. That's less true in like the Washington of the world where there's no income tax, but that's certainly true in New York City where there's a state and city income tax. And it's because these places have created so much activity, so much value, that even if someone wants, even if someone would want to leave, you end up deciding to stay because the value is just so high. And that's where you see the real power of the traditional development pattern, is that the reality is that the value that's created there, you can't just go off and create it, just magically recreate that thing. If you pure wealth and like having like a big mansion next to a bunch of other big mansions, it's just simply not as nice. And those places aren't built to last. And that's what we're starting to see happen in the suburb, is a bunch of billionaires and millionaires and then people with smaller amounts, but still pretty substantial amounts of money have moved out to this location. And what they found is maintaining that, the cost that it costs them in their own tax dollars to maintain that lifestyle, to maintain that style of existence, isn't worth it to them. They don't want to actually pay the taxes that it costs to do that because it's just not worth it. And that they actually probably would be willing to pay more in taxes, generically speaking, right? People, wealthy people actually willing to pay more in taxes to live in these really active places built on that traditional model.
I think that's a really, really good point. And, you know, it gets to what I think is at the core of a strong towns approach for me, which is A, you can't get us to a strong place just by twiddling your tax codes, but B, you got to do it by building a great place. And you have to build great places incrementally over time. I don't want to build an entire New York City over time here because we are going long. I have so much to say about this, John, and it's been a while since I've talked to you. So I don't want to eat up your day. So let's go to the down zone. I want to hear about what you have been reading, watching, listening to, enjoying. You always give me kind of unconventional up zone picks. So you tell me what has been on your media hit list or just your general happiness hit list.
Okay. I'm sure this has probably come up before, but if it hasn't, it's time, which is I love Star Wars. And I love it with deep, unbridled enthusiasm. And here's the thing. I'm not into it. I'm into it as a fan, but not as a nerd. And I can be a very nerdy person, right? I'm showing up on a podcast where we're talking about zoning and land use, right? So I'm not denying that. But I don't really remember all the names of the characters. I couldn't tell you which planet is which all the time. What I know is Ewoks are adorable, right? Wookiees are awesome. Lightsaber fights are amazing. And, you know, I've watched all the movies and I've enjoyed them in the order of the original being great, George Lucas's second attempt not going so well, and these new ones being amazing. And so I am super excited about the final trailer for the 9th and final Star Wars film, this Skywalker trilogy coming out. And in honor of it, today when we're recording this, I know this will come out later, but today when we're recording this, it's actually Halloween. And my dog, Franklin, we got him a costume. He's this gorgeous golden doodle with Wookiee-like fur, and he is appropriately dressed as Chewbacca today for the holidays. So I am digging all things Star Wars, and I am excited to watch the final film in this epic adventure. I think what I love about it most is the mythology of it. George Lucas was a student of a man named Joseph Campbell, who was a professor of mythology, who researched mythology. And my dad actually passed away when I was young, actually kept a quote of Joseph Campbell's taped to his desk. And it's quite lengthy, and I won't attempt to repeat it here. But I think what Joseph Campbell spoke about so profoundly, what I love about Star Wars, is this hero's journey that people are on, that we see repeated in the stories that we tell ourselves as a society and the things that we tell ourselves. And it's about going out into the world, learning something new, going through a personal transformation, and then coming home to make a difference. And I think that Strong Towns at its best is about helping people through that journey, and a simple type of thing where people go out, they discover Strong Towns, they discover a community, and they end up changed, right? They learn something new about how to see the world and new insights. And then they're able to come home and apply those insights to make their home stronger and build change. And that's really the story of Star Wars. And that's really the story of all sorts of our famous myths and powerful legends. And that's really what I think, you know, to me, work is about. And it ties this idea that societal change requires personal transformation.
I love that. And you better believe I'm going to put a photo of your dog in that costume on this post so people can see it for themselves, with your permission, as his parent, of course. But I'm celebrating Halloween in a very different way. I don't have nearly as moving a tribute as you do. I am a big Halloween person. I'm the biggest horror movie fan on the planet. And this year I decided to read a little literary horror novel that I thought was wonderful called The Need by Helen Phillips. It was so, so, so good. So the plot of The Need basically is it opens on a woman who is alone in her house with her two very young children and an intruder is inside, and you don't know who this person is. You soon discover that this person is wearing like a giant paper mache deer mask. What's that about? And very gradually, it becomes clear that this woman's particular backstory is she is a paleobotanist working at, you know, basically the La Brea tar pits, an equivalent sort of like archaeological site. And this person who is in her house might have some mysterious origins. So I'll kind of leave it at that and leave it mysterious. It's a quick read, so you can binge it this Halloween weekend. Halloween is, by the way, not a day of the year. It is a season of the year, 3 months of the year, in my humble opinion. So check it out, The Need by Helen Phillips.
Now, Kia, I feel like if you're going to start promoting horror genre novels, it is important that your listeners know a little more about you that they might not know, right? Which is there is actually a book that I've heard of published back in 2016 by a woman with a very similar name to your own, maybe even identical, called We Eat Our Own. And yeah. Can you give a little tease to the listeners about this book that I believe actually you wrote?
I did, allegedly. Yeah, this always confuses people who know me through Strongtown so much. And I like to just say, like, look, I'm someone who I love two things very passionately, and they might seem like they have nothing to do together with one another, but I think they have a lot to do with one another. My book is called We Eat Our Own. It is a novel fictionalizing true events that actually happened in 1979 and 1980 surrounding the filming of a schlocky cannibal-themed horror movie in the middle of the Amazon rainforest, and the director, who was a little unscrupulous and possibly a little dangerous towards his cast. So it is a horror-adjacent novel. I think there are a lot of tie-ins to land use in this particular book and certainly transportation systems, but you can be the judge. I have yet to talk about the crossover between my work as an urbanist and my work as someone who really just likes like schlocky European horror movies, but I promise you I'm the same person. And if you're shocked by this, give it a read. Let me know what you think. It'll be fun. And maybe my next book will be a little easier to explain to Strongtowners.
No, I think this is so important though, right? Is we have to show up as full people in this work and recognize that we're complex. And that's what I love about this organization, is that there's rich stories behind all the staff and rich stories behind all of our volunteers, and that we are this rich mix of people who have lived these rich and interesting lives. So this, right? So this Halloween, go out and buy Kia's book, go out and buy Chuck's books, go out and read all the Strongtown's books, and go and read all these other recommendations and watch Star Wars and like experience all these different cultural phenomenons and find your own connections between them and see how all these things connect. But of all things, don't build a 1,000-square-foot dining room. Don't go and build miles and miles of roads around your house that you don't want to maintain. You know, that's just nonsense. But do enjoy all the rich culture that we have.
I think that's a beautiful note to end on. Okay, I'm going to go in and dress my dog up in a Halloween costume. He's Superman this year. So thank you so awesome. Much for listening to Upzoned. It was a pleasure talking to you today, John. And keep doing what you can to build a strong town.